There was once a boy named Milo who didn't know what to do with himself. Not just sometimes, but always. When he was in school, he longed to be out. And when he was out, he longed to be in. On the way, he thought about coming home. And coming home, he thought about going. Wherever he was, he wished he were somewhere else. And when he got there, he wondered why he'd bothered. Nothing really interested him, least of all the things that should have. "It seems to me that almost everything is a waste of time," he remarked one day as he walked dejectedly home from school. "I can't see the point in learning to solve useless problems, or subtracting turnips from turnips, or knowing where Ethiopia is, or how to spell February." And, since no one bothered to explain otherwise, he regarded the process of seeking knowledge as the greatest waste of time of all. So begins The Phantom Tollbooth, which I believe to be the greatest children's book in the English language. 6 decades ago, the late Norton Juster, a young architect, received funds from the Ford Foundation in order to write a children's book about the field of urban design. Yes, he was asked to write a children's book about urban design. He tried, but it wasn't working. So he went on vacation to Fire Island to think. And while his time off did not help him in writing this book, it allowed him to conceive of another one. As we are told, and this is where I'm citing this from, as we are told in the introduction to the annotated version of the Phantom Tollbooth, and yes, ladies and gentlemen, there is a scholarly annotated version of the Phantom Tollbooth, and I own it. Juster suddenly recalled a conversation that he had had with a child a few days before. He said, quote, this is what we're told in the annotated Phantom Tollbooth. Quote, a boy of about 10 had sat down next to him and launched into a freewheeling conversation about math. What is the biggest number there is? The boy had gamely demanded. So, I said Juster, tell me what you think the biggest number is. His reply was something like, 1,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000, back and forth, and we were clearly talking about infinity. This led, we are informed by the annotated Phantom Tollbooth, to thinking about numbers, math, knowledge, and learning itself, and that led to the Phantom Tollbooth. The fact is that of all the books that I read as a child, and I thank God had the opportunity of reading many, this one, as many of you know, this children's book is the one that as an adult I have quoted in sermons and speeches and podcasts more than any other. And that is perhaps because the book is not only about a specific adventure. It is, as many note, about the art of learning itself and what we as adults can learn from the way children learn. Milo is a bored boy who sees no value in anything that he is asked to learn. And he has suddenly bequeathed a magical toll booth that takes him into two realms of knowledge, Dictionopolis and Digitopolis, the land of words and the land of numbers, which, at the moment when Milo arrives, are essentially at war with each other because they are its rulers, the king of Dictionopolis, known as King Azaz the Unabridged, and the ruler of Digitopolis, known as the Mathemagician, are in an argument eternally over which is better, words or numbers, and all has gone awry, and the previous peace has come apart because both of these rulers had banished the princesses by the names of rhyme and reason from the realm. Milo sets off on a quest through both Dictionopolis and Digitopolis in order to return the princesses. And through pages and pages of puns, Milo and the reader with him puzzles over the nature of words, numbers, perspective, context, sound, silence, sight, music, and much more. As we prepare for Pesach, this book has helped me consider the Haggadah as the ultimate spiritual toll booth, for its retelling and reenactment actually takes the Jewish child into a realm of imagination and learning. After all, so much of what we do, as Avi mentioned, during Pesach evening, and so much of what we say, so much of what we read, is in the words of Jewish law, Kedei sheyishalu hatinokot, so that the children should ask, so that they should inquire, so that their curiosity should be piqued. And while, of course, our focus on learning and teaching at the Seder is first and foremost on Torah, we do so in a way that Juster described. In other words, in the way that his conversation about infinity took place with the child, in the way that questions lead to questions, which lead to questions, which then set up on the child for further knowledge and further questioning, not just that evening of the Seder, but throughout his or her entire life. And so in tribute to this book that has inspired me so much, I will use passages from this great volume of wisdom in order to help us approach Pesach, which we will be marking very soon. As Avi mentioned in his introduction, it may well be said that the first children's book ever written is the Haggadah. The first Jewish children's book ever written is the Haggadah. The very source in the Torah for the obligation to retell the Pesach story year after year, for the obligation to celebrate the Seder year after year, the very source of the word Haggadah, Haggadah, is Moshe's instruction to Israel on the eve of the Exodus, when he says, V'higadata lebincha bayomahu, you shall tell your child, tell your son on this day. This, for Rabbinic Judaism, means that Moses is obligating us to ensure year after year that the story is retold to children, that our children will be connected to the tale that occurred to our ancestors. Thus, according to Jewish law, though this is often missed, if your own discussion and retelling of the Seder drags on so that the children that are present there fall asleep and fail to experience most of the ritual, then that is, in a certain sense, a Seder gone awry. Because if there are children present at one Seder, then the ritual is not about you, it is about them. This means, strikingly, that a Seder that achieves a level of sophistication that surpasses the cognition of children is, if children are there, not an ideal Seder. And if children are actually present and fail to comprehend what is taking place, then it's a failed Seder. There's a good friend of mine who was studying in yeshiva in Israel, and he was invited to the Seder of Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein, one of the great of blessed memory, one of the great Talmudists of our time, a man who was a towering intellect, who had a doctorate from Harvard in English literature. And this young man arrived at the Seder expecting the intellectual experience of a lifetime. And all Rabbi Lichtenstein did the whole time is ignore his students and focus on his grandchildren, sparking their imagination with seemingly simple questions in order to inspire the youngest participants in the Seder, saying things like, Eizeh shulchan dafuk yesh kan? What a strange table we have here. And my friend told me that the child replied in Hebrew, what a strange guest we have here, pointing at him. Children, you might think, detract from the intellectual level of conversation. That is why, if you are planning to create a meal in which you would discuss over wine the nature of freedom of covenant, your first thought might not be, hey, let's do it with three-year-old kids. The Seder is often compared by academics to a Greek symposium. But when we think about the most famous of those symposia, which is Plato's symposium in his dialogue about Socrates, there is not a child in sight. On the contrary, it is the best and brightest of Greek society. Socrates is there, Alcibiades is there, there are physicians and philosophers, scholars and statesmen, and no one has come and said, hey, I brought the kids. That ruins the conversation. I remember a story about the writer and publisher Lucianne Goldberg. I think this was actually told by her son, the writer Jonah Goldberg, who was trying to illustrate what New York was like in the 1970s. And they described that she showed up to a fancy restaurant for an event, and she had her child with her. So she went to the coat check and checked the child at the coat check. That's what you could do in those days. I think that's a true story. And while I often joke at airports, because Soloveitchik family never checks luggage, that's one of our ironclad rules of travel, I have thought about, you know, checking one or two of the kids. It would save cash. So I've thought about it, but the truth is, where we'd really think about it is if you were showing up to an intellectual evening discussing some of the most important intellectual topics at the heart of Judaism, freedom, the nature of law, the nature of covenant. You would say, you know what? Maybe I'll just coat check the kids when I show up. But no, The Seder is the exact opposite. It's all about children. We begin with seemingly simple questions, and we're obligated to answer their questions, no matter their maturity or ability. The implication of the Haggadah is that the very purpose of the Torah is that it can be taught to children, and that this obligation is most importantly fulfilled on Pesach evening, when we are instructed to engage children that possess a variety of intellectual and moral qualities and capacities. Our obligation spans them all. Chacham, the wise child. Tam, the simple child. She'eni yodea lishal, the immature child who is not old enough even to ask. We must engage every single one of them. Children are so central to the Festival of Freedom that the very term of the work known as the Haggadah derives its name from the obligation of retelling and reenacting the story of our liberation to the youngest members of Israelite society. And while of course this is first and foremost meant to be a matter of education of our progeny, perhaps the case can be made that we are instructed to retell the story of the Exodus to our children, not only in order to spark their imaginations, but also to spark our own. In other words, perhaps the Seder is meant to help us, in retelling the tale, see the story through our children's and grandchildren's eyes, to see things from a child's perspective. A friend of mine, Rabbi Donnie Besser, once commented to me that adults are meant not only to educate children at the Seder, but to relive the story through the child's perspective. And I think this is an excellent point. And to this I would add that in truth, there is no one single child's perspective, because the child at various points in his or her own development sees things differently. And for us in the Haggadah, this is true as well. This brings us to one wonderful moment in the Phantom Tollbooth, when Milo and his entourage encounter a boy his own age named Alec. But Alec's head is much higher than Milo's, as you see on the screen, for he walks on air. Milo wonders how this is, and the boy explains, quote, "Well," said the boy, "in my family, everyone is born in the air, with his head at exactly the height it's going to be when he's an adult. And then we all grow toward the ground. When we're fully grown up, or as you can see, grown down, our feet finally touch. Of course, there are a few of us whose feet never reach the ground, no matter how old we get. But I suppose it's the same in every family." And then, this boy floating on air, Alec, says to Milo, seeing that he's standing on the ground, "You certainly must be very old to have reached ground already." "Oh no," said Milo seriously. "In my family, we all start on the ground and grow up, and we never know how far until we actually get there." "What a silly system," the boy laughed. "Then your head keeps changing its height, and you always see things in a different way? Why, when you're 15, things won't look at all the way they did when you were 10, and at 20, everything will change again." "I suppose so," replied Milo, for he had never really thought about the matter. Norton Juster is giving us in this book a profound and poignant point about life. We see things differently at different points in our development. And at the Seder, if we are teaching very tiny children and slightly older children and mature children, it's because we are actually attempting to incorporate all these perspectives. We are obligated to tell the story to a little baby, to a little child, to a simple son, to an educated child, because they are all valuable. Let's give one example of this. When we're speaking about the child known as the Tam in the Haggadah, usually translated the simple son, we're not merely describing a child of basic development. Rather, we are being given the archetype of a boy or girl that is just young enough still to have a sense of wonder at the discovery of knowledge. Simple is not the same as simplistic. In one wonderful sermon, my teacher, Rabbi Norman Lamb, reflected how we are at the Seder not only obligated to engage the Tam, the young, inexperienced child, we are obligated to learn from that child, from the child's simple faith and wonder at the world, in the awe and interest expressed in the text when the child is depicted as saying two words, "Mazos, what is this?" Because we can learn a great deal just from that question. In a world of so much cynicism, and the wicked child is meant to embody cynicism, we seek to adopt the child's perspective in our own learning. Rabbi Lamb put it this way, quote, "We live in a world where, unfortunately, the Russia, the wicked son, the cynical son, reigns supreme. It is not enough," he wrote, "in this kind of environment, to emphasize the chacham, the wise son, the educated son, alone. For while it is true that wisdom is indispensable both to general life and Jewish living, it is equally true that beyond all the complexities and subtleties that tantalize man's mind and confound his understanding, there stands the simple and sublime truth of the one God, author of all. What we need," he said, "is the Tam, the simple son, one who can include wisdom in his personality and transcend it, one who can possess scholarship without displaying pretentiousness, who can develop his intellect and yet, in the moment he turns to his God, abandon his self-consciousness and serve his maker with wonder," end quote. In other words, we all, to use the passage in the Phantom Tollbooth, we all grow up. Our heads metaphorically and literally reach higher and higher until we stop growing. But we need to remember the other ways in which we once saw the world, not just our different heights, but our different perspectives, and to incorporate those perspectives in our lives. Thus, at a certain point in the story, Milo asks Alec as follows. "Would it be possible for me to see something from up there?" asked Milo politely. "You could," said Alec, "but only if you try very hard to look at things as an adult does." Milo, we are told in the book, tried as hard as he could, and as he did, his feet floated slowly off the ground until he was standing in the air next to Alec. He looked around very quickly and an instant later crashed back down to the earth again. "Interesting, wasn't it?" asked Alec. "Yes, it was," agreed Milo, rubbing his head and dusting himself off. "But I think I'll continue to see things as a child. It's not so far to fall." So we are told, to see things as a child, or as Raylan put it, to see things as the simple son who is not simplistic would see it, is to look at the world with wonder. As I mentioned in an episode of Parsha and Politics, this passage in the Phantom Tollbooth reminds one of the psychologist Alison Gopnik's book, The Philosophical Baby. The provocative title highlights how the book inspires us to ponder how little children think and see the world. For Gopnik, adults focus single-mindedly on one aspect of reality. And in that moment, a focus see little else. But children, she tells us, approach the world with constant curiosity. And because their vision and interest ranges widely, they are actually, in a certain sense, more conscious than adults. Gopnik utilizes the phrase spotlight consciousness to describe the adult experience of the world. And she cites a famous psychological experiment. This is what she writes, quote, "For adults, attention can also be endogenous, directed voluntarily at particular objects, like that spotlight. In this case, attending to one thing can actually make us much less conscious of the other things around us, even salient or new or unexpected things." And she adds, "Some psychologists call it inattentional blindness. In one dramatic experiment designed by Dan Simons, you look at a video of several people throwing a ball. The instruction is to count the number of items the number of times the ball goes from hand to hand. The players weave in and out, so this takes some effort. It's like trying to follow the pea in the old shell game. Then the experimenter asks if you notice anything strange. Nothing, you say. Now he plays the video again, but this time he says, you don't have to follow the ball. And you see that someone in a gorilla suit walks slowly right through the middle of the screen. You were looking right at the gorilla, but literally didn't see it because your attention was so focused on the ball." End quote. In contrast, children take everything in. Their vision alights on one aspect of existence, then another. And that's why Gopnik calls the way they see the world not spotlight consciousness, but lantern consciousness. And children, she says, in a certain sense, see better than adults. That's why they're more conscious than adults. They see when we often do not. And as we grow older, we lose our lantern consciousness, which means that while we gain the ability to focus, we often lose our sense of wonder applied to our existence. If there's a scene in the Phantom Tollbooth that captures this, it's to be found in a passage where Alec, the floating boy, takes Milo to a land where there are no buildings or gardens or stories. But everyone who lives in this land is always walking with his or her head facing the ground like this, back and forth, back and forth. And As they are walking back and forth, they act as if buildings are there, entering apparently invisible edifices or exiting them, as if they exist, but they're not there. Milo is told by Alec that this land with nothing in it is called reality. Alec explains. Many years ago, on this very spot, there was a beautiful city of fine houses and inviting spaces, and no one who lived here was ever in a hurry. The streets were full of wonderful things to see, and the people would often stop to look at them. Didn't they have any place to go, asked Milo? To be sure, continued Alec. But as you know, the most important reason for going from one place to another is to see what's in between. And they took great pleasure in doing just that. Then one day, Alec continued, someone discovered that if you walked as fast as possible and looked at nothing but your shoes, you would arrive at your destination much more quickly. Soon everyone was doing it. They all rushed down the avenues and hurried along the boulevards, seeing nothing of the wonders and beauties of their city as they went. Milo, we are told, remembered the many times he'd done the very same thing. And as hard as he tried, there were even things on his own street that he couldn't remember. And Alec continued, no one paid any attention to how things looked. And as they moved faster and faster, everything grew uglier and dirtier. And as everything grew uglier and dirtier, they moved faster and faster. And at last, a very strange thing began to happen. Because nobody cared, the city slowly began to disappear. Day by day, the buildings grew fainter and fainter, and the streets faded away, until at last it was entirely invisible. There was nothing to see at all. Hasn't anyone told them, asked Milo, meaning hasn't anyone told them that their city has disappeared? And Alec replies, it doesn't do any good, for they can never see what they're in too much of a hurry to look for. In the end, the point of the Seder is to learn, at least in part, is to learn from our children to see our story, our history, with wonder. Not despite the difficulties of Jewish history, but precisely in the face of it. Precisely in the face of it. I've been teaching this year, this semester at Yeshiva University, Josephus's work, The Jewish War, which describes the Jerusalem's revolt against Rome in 66 CE and the destruction of the temple in 70. And just this past week, as we read of the destruction of Jerusalem, Josephus tells us, and we read in class, how Titus comes, after the temple is destroyed, comes across from the temple toward the upper city of Jerusalem, across the bridge. And I told the students, you have seen this bridge. It's what's called Wilson's Arch. It's that arch at the Kotel. So people, when they want to pray, go inside. And Titus tells the Jews to surrender, and he says to them, how could you even think that you could defeat Rome? We defeated the Carthaginians. And then I stopped and I said to my students, I said, think about this for a minute. We're reading a text from 2,000 years ago describing a city where you've all been, and you've been there as a Jewish city. Titus is describing Carthage as the strongest foe the Romans have ever faced. Is there anyone in Carthage? Is there a Carthaginian university where people are reading about the Punic War and speaking about, oh yes, I've been to that Carthaginian city. I've been in there. I've stood there. Can we not see what a wonder Jewish history is? And isn't it easy to forget in our adult lives the wonder and the nature of our story? We have this wonder not despite the difficulties that the Jewish people face, not despite the enemies, as we say in the Haggadah, that seek to destroy us in every generation, but precisely because of it. When Milo first sets out to find the princess's rhyme and reason, he is told by both the king of Dictionopolis and the ruler of Digitopolis that while they support his quest, there is something important that they know about his quest that he does not know. But they can't tell him until he returns. And at the end of the book, when he succeeds in bringing rhyme and reason back and restoring peace and harmony to the two lands, the rulers say to him, there was one very important thing about your quest that we couldn't discuss until you returned. I remember, said Milo eagerly. Tell me now. It was impossible, said the king. And then he adds, completely impossible. But if we told you then, you might not have gone. And as you've discovered, so many things are possible, just as long as you don't know they're impossible. That, of course, is ultimately the story of the Jewish journey throughout history. And it is our child's wonder at our story that is meant to inspire us to look at history in the same way, not discarding our maturity, but assimilating their wonder into our own educated perspective. And as much as our children are there to help us, it is, of course, first and foremost, we who are at the Seder to teach them. And the point of the learning experience in the Haggadah, I've come to realize, is not only to teach them about Pesach, but to jumpstart them in a magical journey of learning for the rest of their lives, to inspire them thereby, and perhaps also to inspire ourselves to continue to grow in our learning day by day. In the Phantom Tollbooth, after Milo succeeds in rescuing Rhyme and Reason, we are taught in the book to see his entire journey and his successes and failures along the way as a metaphor for the life of learning itself. Speaking to the two princesses, he says to them, "But there's so much to learn." "Yes, that's true," admitted Rhyme, "but it's not learning things that's important. It's what to do with what you learn and learning why you learn things at all that matters." "That's just what I mean," explained Milo. And he adds, "Many of the things I'm supposed to know seem so useless that I can't see the purpose in learning them at all." "You may not see it now," said the Princess of Pure Reason, looking knowingly at Milo's puzzled face. "But whatever we learn has a purpose, and whatever we do affects everything and everyone else, if even in the tiniest way. Why, when a housefly flaps his wings, a breeze goes around the world. When a speck of dust falls to the ground, the entire planet weighs a little more. And when you stamp your foot, the earth moves slightly off its course. Whenever you laugh, gladness spreads like the ripples in the pond, and whenever you're sad, no one anywhere can really be happy." And it's much the same thing with knowledge, she added. "For whenever you learn something new, the whole world becomes that much richer." And then the other princess adds, "And remember also that," and this is the critical quote, "remember also that many places you would like to see are just off the map, and many things you know are just out of sight or a little beyond your reach. But someday you'll reach them all, for what you learn today for no reason at all will help you discover all the wonderful secrets of tomorrow." So she says, and thus does this one adventure in which Milo enters set him up for learning for the rest of his life. This may not always sound exciting. I remember hearing an interview with a Supreme Court justice who was asked what he does at work, and he says, "Oh, I read briefs, and then I write, and then I read briefs, and I write." And he said that he told his children, "You see, if you work hard and do your homework, you can get a job where you do homework for the rest of your life." But the truth is, by the end of the Phantom Tollbooth, Juster has made the act of learning so exciting, so enjoyable, that we feel with Milo that what Rhyme and Reason, these princesses, tell him is true. That learning itself is the most enriching of experiences and will ultimately impact our lives in ways we can scarcely imagine in the moment. It's interesting that for Judaism, the act of Torah study is never called study. It is known as limud, learning. For no matter how old one is or how advanced one is in Torah, there is always more to learn. And that, of course, is why we introduce the discussion of the four sons in the Haggadah with the phrase, Baruch HaMakom Baruch Hu, Baruch Shenatan Torah LaAmo Yisrael Baruch Hu. Blessed is God who gave us the Torah. Blessed is He. And then we immediately, without any seeming segue, say, the Torah spoke about four sons. The point, as my great-great-grandfather explained, is that the Torah speaks to everyone. It speaks to children, and it speaks to adults. And we are always learners. We are always engaged in the act of learning more. In the book, a map is given to us by the Phantom Tollbooth of the realms in which Milo traveled. And the truth is, that is the road to life for us all, because we are meant to explore both Dictionopolis and Digitopolis, both the land of words and the land of numbers. And we are meant to avoid what is given to us in the map as the most dangerous location of all, the mountains of ignorance. These realms of knowledge are built, if you look in the map that the book gives us, abut an ocean known as the Sea of Knowledge. The same metaphor of the Sea of Knowledge is invoked in the great Mishnaic by the great Mishnaic sages in describing the Torah. They are depicted in the Medrash as describing both the lengths and the limits of their knowledge. And here I quote one translation. Rabbi Eliezer said, "If all seas were ink, all reeds quills, heaven and earth scrolls, and all men scribes, they would not suffice to write down the amount of Torah I have learned, even though I abstracted no more from it than a man might take by dipping a painting stick in the sea." And then another colleague echoes him. We are presented with sage after sage who devoted his life to Torah learning, but who continues to discover that he has more to learn. The Haggadah is meant not merely to give us a magical evening of learning and of knowledge. It's meant to inspire us, adults and children, to a lifetime of learning. And as we learn that there is always more to learn, we actually connect with God himself. In one passage in the Phantom Tollbooth, the one that was inspired by the original conversation that the author had with a child that gave him the idea for the book, Milo visits Digitopolis, the land of numbers, and he asks to see the number of the greatest magnitude. He, in turn, is informed that the name of that number is infinity, and it can be found up a nearby staircase. And he climbs stairs after stairs because he's eager to discover so vast a number. Up the stairs he goes, and we are told. Up he went, very quick at first, then more slowly, then in a little while even more slowly than that. And finally, after many minutes of climbing up the endless stairway, one weary foot was barely able to follow the other. Milo suddenly realized that with all his effort, he was no closer to the top than when he began, and not a great deal further from the bottom. But he struggled on for a while longer until at last completely collapsed onto one of the steps. At this point in the book, Milo looks up and he sees a half a boy, meaning a boy with a full side of him visible but half missing. And we're told, "Pardon me for staring," said Milo, after he had been staring for some time, "but I've never seen half a child before." "It's 0.58 to be precise," replied the child from the left side of his mouth, which happened to be the only side of his mouth. So they have a whole conversation about being 0.58 of a boy and why he's 0.58. So Milo says, "What's the rest of your family like?" And he says, "Oh, we're just the average family. Mother, father, and 2.58 children. And as I explained, I'm the 0.58. He is, in other words, the embodiment of an average. Of an average. The average family, when the book was written, had 2.58 children. He's the 0.58. So Milo says to him something like, "That must be difficult, being only 0.58 of a child." And the child replies, "No, it's awesome, because the average family has 1.3 automobiles, and I'm the only one who can drive the 0.3 of a car." So they have a whole conversation about averages. And Milo replies, "But averages aren't real." And the 0.58 of a boy responds, "One of the things about mathematics, or anything else you might care to learn, is that many of the things which can never be often are. You see," he says, "it's very much like you're trying to reach infinity. You know that it's there, but you just don't know where. But just because you can never reach it doesn't mean that it's not worth looking for." And Milo responds, "I hadn't thought of it that way. I think I'll go back now." And the 0.58 of a child replies, "A wise decision, but try again someday. Perhaps you'll get much closer." The point, of course, is that counterintuitively, in failing to reach infinity, in going up the stairs and up the stairs and up the stairs and never reaching infinity, Milo suddenly understands better what infinity actually is. In the failure to reach it, he touches it just for a moment. So it is with us. In trying to reach infinity, we sense it itself. And that, I think, is the meaning of the Midrash, of the rabbis surfing the sea of knowledge, learning more than others have come before them, and yet still realizing they've only taken a bit of what there is from the Torah to learn, as a painting stick stuck in the sea. Because in the nature of the law, we comprehend the nature of the lawgiver. The rabbis of the Mishnah were delighted rather than dismayed with the boundless nature of the Torah itself, with the fact that for all they had learned, they sensed how much more they had to learn and how much more they had yet to learn. They were delighted because in the infinitude of knowledge, they glimpsed the infinitude of the mind of the Almighty. This, then, is the journey that is the Haggadah, the portal, the toll booth to learning that is Pesach evening. Adults learn from the children's wonder, and the children learn about learning itself. The point, ultimately, of the evening is not only to give the child a magical moment, though there is, of course, that. But to train children to see all of life as a learning experiment, as a learning experience, which for us is first and foremost through the Torah. The Pesach evening is indeed miraculous, but it will come to a close. The question is what will follow after that, whether the child will be inspired by the evening to learn more about his or her heritage, and whether we will be inspired likewise. In the final page of the Phantom Tollbooth, Milo journeys through the Tollbooth home to his original world, and he goes to school. He comes back eager to journey again through the Tollbooth to find that the Tollbooth has been taken away. For there is another child who is in need of it, another child who needs to learn about learning, who needs to know about knowledge. But he has discovered as he sits there that his dismay is transferred to delight because that one trip has changed his entire perspective. And so we are told, even as he thought of all these things, he noticed somehow that the sky was a lovely shade of blue and that one cloud had the shape of a sailing ship. The tips of the trees held pale young buds and the leaves were a rich deep green. Outside the window, there was so much to see and hear and touch. Walks to take, hills to climb, caterpillars to watch as they strolled through the garden. There were voices to hear and conversations to listen to and wonder, and the special smell of each day. And in the very room in which he sat, there were books that could take you anywhere, and things to invent and make and build and break, and all the puzzle and excitement of everything he didn't know. Music to play, songs to sing, and worlds to imagine, and then someday make real. His thoughts darted earlier about, as everything looked new. Well, I would like to make another trip, he said, jumping to his feet. But I really don't know when I'll have the time. There's just so much to do right here. So the book ends. In the end, for adults as for children, the magic of Pesach evening will dissipate. The journey through the realm of imagination will come to an end because all wondrous experiences come to a close. As we say in the last words of the Haggadah, Chazal Sidur Pesach, we have finished telling the story. Or, as the students say to their teachers in the Haggadah, as they are continuing their extraordinary evening, Higi Azman Kriyat Shema Shel Shacharit, the time of the morning Shema has arrived. The evening has come to a close. All extraordinary evenings come to an end. But the question is whether that evening will be for our children and for us only the beginning, and whether our entry through the spiritual Tollbooth that is the Haggadah will mark the start of a journey of learning toward God, the ultimate infinity of all. Thank you very much.